actuators that made contact with my skin every few centimeters. These could be activated in small or large groups for the purpose of tactile simulation, to make my skin feel things that weren't really there. They could convincingly simulate the sensation of a tap on the shoulder, a kick to the shin, or a gunshot in the chest. Built-in safety software prevented my rig from actually causing me any physical harm, so a simulated gunshot actually felt more like a weak punch. I had an identical backup suit hanging in the Moshwash cleaning unit in the corner of the room. These two haptic suits made up my entire wardrobe. My old street clothes were buried somewhere in the closet, collecting dust. On my hands, I wore a pair of state-of-the-art Okagami Idle Hands haptic data gloves. Special tactile feedback pads covered both palms, allowing the gloves to create the illusion that I was touching objects and surfaces that didn't actually exist. My visor was a brand new pair of Dynatro RLR 7800 Rec Specs, featuring a top-of-the-line virtual retinal display. The visor drew the oasis directly onto my retinas at the highest frame rate and resolution perceptible to the human eye. The real world looked washed out and blurry by comparison. The RLR 7800 was a not yet available to the plebeian masses prototype, but I had an endorsement deal with Dynatro, so they sent me free gear, shipped to me through a series of remailing services, which I used to maintain my anonymity. My Abound Sound audio system consisted of an array of ultra-thin speakers mounted on the apartment's walls, floor, and ceiling, providing 360 degrees of perfect spatial pin-drop sound reproduction. And the Mjolnir subwoofer was powerful enough to make my back teeth vibrate. The olfactory smell tower in the corner was capable of generating over 2,000 discernible odors. A rose garden, salty ocean wind, burning cordite. The tower could convincingly recreate them all. It also doubled as an industrial-strength air conditioner slash purifier, which was primarily what I used it for. A lot of jokers liked to code really horrific smells into their simulations just to mess with people who owned smell towers, so I usually left the odor generator disabled, unless I was in a part of the oasis where I thought being able to smell my surroundings might prove useful. On the floor, directly underneath my suspended haptic chair, was my Okagami runaround omnidirectional treadmill. No matter where you go, there you are, was the manufacturer's slogan. The treadmill was about 2 meters square and 6 centimeters thick. When it was activated, I could run at top speed in any direction and never reach the edge of the platform. If I changed direction, the treadmill would sense it, and its rolling surface would change direction to match me, always keeping my body near the center of its platform. This model was also equipped with built-in lifts and an amorphous surface so that it could simulate walking up inclines and staircases. You could also purchase an ACHD, anatomically correct haptic doll, if you wanted to have more intimate encounters inside the oasis. ACHDs came in male, female, and dual-sex models, and were available with a wide array of options. Realistic latex skin, servomotor-driven endoskeletons, simulated musculature, and all of the attendant appendages and orifices one would imagine. Driven by loneliness, curiosity, and raging teen hormones, I'd purchased a mid-range ACHD, the Shaptic Uber Betty, a few weeks after Artemis stopped speaking to me. After spending several highly unproductive days inside a standalone brothel simulation called the Pleasure Dome, I'd gotten rid of the doll out of a combination of shame and self-preservation. I'd wasted thousands of credits, missed a whole week of work, and was on the verge of completely abandoning my quest for the egg when I confronted the grim realization that virtual sex, no matter how realistic, was really nothing but glorified computer-assisted masturbation. At the end of the day, I was still a virgin, all alone in a dark room, humping a lubed-up robot. So, I got rid of the ACHD and went back to spanking the monkey the old-fashioned way. I felt no shame about masturbating. Thanks to Anorak's Almanac, I now thought of it as a normal bodily function, as necessary and natural as sleeping or eating. AA24187. I would argue that masturbation is the human animal's most important adaptation, the very cornerstone of our technological civilization. Our hands evolved to grip tools, all right, including our own. You see, thinkers, inventors, and scientists are usually geeks, and geeks have a harder time getting laid than anyone. Without the built-in sexual release valve provided by masturbation, it's doubtful that early humans would have ever mastered the secrets of fire or discovered the wheel. And you can bet that Galileo, Newton, and Einstein never would have made their discoveries if they hadn't first been able to clear their heads by slapping the salami, or knocking a few protons off the old hydrogen atom. The same goes for Marie Curie. Before she discovered radium, you can be certain she first discovered the little man in the canoe. It wasn't one of Halliday's more popular theories, but I liked it. As I shuffled over to the toilet, a large flat-screen monitor mounted on the wall switched on, and the smiling face of Max, my system agent software, appeared on the screen. I'd programmed Max to start up a few minutes after I turned on the lights so I could wake up a little bit before he started jabbering to me. "Good morning, Wade," Max stuttered cheerily. "Rise and shine!" Running system agent software was a little like having a virtual personal assistant, one that also functioned as a voice-activated interface with your computer. System agent software was highly configurable, with hundreds of pre-programmed personalities to choose from. I'd programmed mine to look, sound, and behave like Max Headroom, the ostensibly computer-generated star of a late 80s talk show, a groundbreaking cyberpunk TV series, and a slew of Coke commercials. "Good morning, Max," I replied groggily. "I think you mean good evening, Rumpelstiltskin. It's 7:18 p.m., Oasis, just a standard time, Wednesday, December 30th. Max was programmed to speak with a slight electronic stutter. In the mid-80s, when the character of Max Headroom was created, computers weren't actually powerful enough to generate a photorealistic human figure, so Max had been portrayed by an actor, the brilliant Matt Frewer, who wore a lot of rubber makeup to make him look computer-generated. But the version of Max now smiling at me on the monitor was pure software, with the best simulated AI and voice recognition subroutines money could buy. I'd been running a highly customized version of Max Headroom version 3.4.1 for a few weeks now. Before that, my system agent software had been modeled after the actress Erin Gray of Buck Rogers and Silver Spoons fame, but she'd proved to be way too distracting, so I'd switched to Max. He was annoying at times, but he also cracked me up. He did a pretty decent job of keeping me from feeling lonesome, too. As I stumbled into the bathroom module and emptied my bladder, Max continued to address me from a small monitor mounted above the mirror. "Uh-oh! It appears you sprung a leak," he said. "Get a new joke," I said. "Any news I should know about?" "Just the usual. Wars, rioting, famine, nothing that would interest you." "Any messages?" He rolled his eyes. "A few, but to answer your real question, no. Artemis still hasn't called or written you back, lover boy." "I've warned you. Don't call me that, Max. You're begging to be deleted." "Touchy, touchy. Honestly, Wade, when did you get so sensitive? I'll erase you, Max. I mean it. Keep it up, and I'll switch back to Wilma Deering. Or I'll try out the disembodied voice of Majel Barrett." Max made a pouty face and spun around to face the shifting digital wallpaper behind him, currently a pattern of multicolored vector lines. Max was always like this. Giving me grief was part of his pre-programmed personality. I actually sort of enjoyed it because it reminded me of hanging out with H, and I really missed hanging out with H. A lot. My gaze dropped to the bathroom mirror, but I didn't much like what I saw there, so I closed my eyes until I finished urinating. I wondered, not for the first time, why I hadn't painted the mirror black too when I'd done the window. The hour or so after I woke up was my least favorite part of each day because I spent it in the real world. This was when I dealt with the tedious business of cleaning and exercising my physical body. I hated this part of the day because everything about it contradicted my other life, my real life inside the oasis. The sight of my tiny one-room apartment, my immersion rig, or my reflection in the mirror, they all served as a harsh reminder that the world I spent my days in was not, in fact, the real one. "Retract chair," I said as I stepped out of the bathroom. The haptic chair instantly flattened itself again, then retracted so that it was flush against the wall, clearing a large empty space in the center of the room. I pulled on my visor and loaded up the gym, a standalone simulation. Now I was standing in a large, modern fitness center lined with exercise equipment and weight machines, all of which could be perfectly simulated by my haptic suit. I began my daily workout. Sit-ups, stomach crunches, push-ups, aerobics, weight training. Occasionally, Max would shout words of encouragement. "Get those legs up, you sissy! Feel the burn!" I usually got a little exercise while logged into the Oasis by engaging in physical combat or running around the virtual landscape on my treadmill, but I spent the vast majority of my time sitting in my haptic chair, getting almost no exercise at all. I also had a habit of overeating when I was depressed or frustrated, which was most of the time. As a result, I'd gradually started to put on some extra pounds. I wasn't in the best shape to begin with, so I quickly reached a point where I could no longer fit comfortably in my haptic chair or squeeze into my XL haptic suit. Soon, I would need to buy a new rig, with components from the Husky line. I knew that if I didn't get my weight under control, I would probably die of sloth before I found the egg. I couldn't let that happen. So I made a snap decision and enabled the voluntary Oasis Fitness Lockout software on my rig. I'd regretted it almost immediately. From then on, my computer monitored my vital signs and kept track of exactly how many calories I burned during the course of each day. If I didn't meet my daily exercise requirements, the system prevented me from logging into my Oasis account. This meant that I couldn't go to work, continue my quest, or, in effect, live my life. Once the lockout was engaged, you couldn't disable it for 2 months, and the software was bound to my Oasis account, so I couldn't just buy a new computer or go rent a booth in some public Oasis cafe. If I wanted to log in, I had no choice but to exercise first. This proved to be the only motivation I needed. The lockout software also monitored my dietary intake. Each day, I was allowed to select meals from a preset menu of healthy, low-calorie foods. The software would order the food for me online, and it would be delivered to my door. Since I never left my apartment, it was easy for the program to keep track of everything I ate. If I ordered additional food on my own, it would increase the amount of exercise I had to do each day to offset my additional calorie intake. This was some sadistic software. But it worked. The pounds began to melt off, and after a few months, I was in near-perfect health. For the first time in my life, I had a flat stomach and muscles. I also had twice the energy, and I got sick a lot less frequently. When the 2 months ended, and I was finally given the option to disable the fitness lockout, I decided to keep it in place. Now, exercising was part of my daily ritual. Once I finished with my weight training, I stepped onto my treadmill. "Begin morning run," I said to Max. "Bifrost track." The virtual gym vanished. Now, I was standing on a semi-transparent running track, a curved, looping ribbon suspended in a starry nebula. Giant ringed planets and multicolored moons were suspended in space all around me. The running track stretched out ahead of me, rising, falling, and occasionally spiraling into a helix. An invisible barrier prevented me from accidentally running off the edge of the track and plummeting into the starry abyss. The Bifrost track was another standalone simulation, one of several hundred track designs stored on my console's hard drive. As I began to run, Max fired up my 80s music playlist. As the first song began, I quickly rattled off its title, artist, album, and year of release from memory. A Million Miles Away, The Plimsolls, Everywhere at Once, 1983. Then I began to sing along, reciting the lyrics. Having the right 80s song lyric memorized might save my avatar's life someday. When I finished my run, I pulled off my visor and began removing my haptic suit. This had to be done slowly to prevent damaging the suit's components. As I carefully peeled it off, the contact patches made tiny popping sounds as they pulled free of my skin, leaving tiny circular marks all over my body. Once I had the suit off, I placed it inside the cleaning unit and laid my clean spare suit out on the floor. Max had already turned on the shower for me, setting the water temperature right where I liked it. As I jumped into the steam-filled stall, Max switched the music over to my shower tunes playlist. I recognized the opening riffs of Change by John Waite from the Vision Quest soundtrack, Geffen Records, 1985. The shower worked a lot like an old car wash. I just stood there while it did most of the work, blasting me from all angles with jets of soapy water, then rinsing me off. I had no hair to wash because the shower also dispensed a non-toxic hair-removing solution that I rubbed all over my face and body. This eliminated the need for me to shave or cut my hair, both hassles I didn't need. Having smooth skin also helped make sure my haptic suit fit snugly. I looked a little freaky without any eyebrows, but I got used to it. When the rinse jets cut off, the blow dryers kicked on, blasting the moisture off of my skin in a matter of seconds. I stepped into the kitchen and took out a can of sludge, a high-protein, vitamin D-infused breakfast drink, to help counteract my sunlight deprivation. As I gulped it down, my computer's sensors silently took note, scanning the barcode and adding the calories to my total for the day. With breakfast out of the way, I pulled on my clean haptic suit. This was less tricky than taking the suit off, but it still took time to do properly. Once I had the suit on, I ordered the haptic chair to extend. Then I paused and spent a moment staring at my immersion rig. I'd been so proud of all this high-tech hardware when I'd first purchased it. But over the past few months, I'd come to see my rig for what it was. An elaborate contraption for deceiving my senses, to allow me to live in a world that didn't exist. Each component of my rig was a bar in the cell where I had willingly imprisoned myself. Standing there, under the bleak fluorescence of my tiny one-room apartment, there was no escaping the truth. In real life, I was nothing but an antisocial hermit, a recluse, a pale-skinned, pop culture-obsessed geek, an agoraphobic shut-in with no real friends, family, or genuine human contact. I was just another sad, lost, lonely soul, wasting his life on a glorified video game. But not in the Oasis. In there, I was the great Parzival, world-famous Gunter and international celebrity. People asked for my autograph. I had a fan club, several, actually. I was recognized everywhere I went, but only when I wanted to be. I was paid to endorse products. People admired and looked up to me. I got invited to the most exclusive parties. I went to all the hippest clubs and never had to wait in line. I was a pop culture icon, a VR rock star. And in Gunter circles, I was a legend. Nay, a god. I sat down and pulled on my gloves and visor. Once my identity was verified, the Gregarious Simulation Systems logo appeared in front of me, followed by the login prompt. "Greetings, Parzival. Please, speak your passphrase." I cleared my throat and recited my passphrase. Each word appeared on my display as I said it. "No one in the world ever gets what they want, and that is beautiful." There was a brief pause, and then I let out an involuntary sigh of relief as the oasis faded into existence all around me. Chapter 20. My avatar slowly materialized in front of the control panel in my stronghold's command center, the same spot where I'd been sitting the night before, engaged in my evening ritual of staring blankly at the quatrain until I drifted off to sleep and the system logged me out. I'd been staring at the damn thing for almost 6 months now, and I still hadn't been able to decipher it. No one had. Everyone had theories, of course, but the jade key still remained unfound, and top rankings on the scoreboard remained static. My command center was located under an armored dome embedded in the rocky surface of my own private asteroid. From here, I had a sweeping 360-degree view of the surrounding cratered landscape, stretching to the horizon in all directions. The rest of my stronghold was below ground, in a vast subterranean complex that stretched all the way to the asteroid's core. I'd coded the entire thing myself, shortly after moving to Columbus. My avatar needed a stronghold, and I didn't want any neighbors, so I'd bought the cheapest planetoid I could find, this tiny barren asteroid in Sector 14. Its designation was S14A316, but I'd renamed it Falco, after the Austrian rap star. I wasn't a huge Falco fan or anything. I just thought it sounded like a cool name. Falco only had a few square kilometers of surface area, but it had still cost me a pretty penny. It had been worth it, though. When you owned your own world, you could build whatever you wanted there. And no one could visit it unless I granted them access, something I never gave to anyone. My stronghold was my home inside the oasis, my avatar's sanctuary. It was the one place in the entire simulation where I was truly safe. As soon as my login sequence completed, a window popped up on my display, informing me that today was an election day. Now that I was 18, I could vote in both the oasis elections and the elections for U.S. government officials. I didn't bother with the latter because I didn't see the point. The once great country into which I'd been born now resembled its former self in name only. It didn't matter who was in charge. Those people were rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, and everyone knew it. Besides, now that everyone could vote from home via the Oasis, the only people who could get elected were movie stars, reality TV personalities, or radical televangelists. I did take the time to vote in the Oasis elections, however, because their outcomes actually affected me. The voting process only took me a few minutes, because I was already familiar with all of the major issues GSS had put on the ballot. It was also time to elect the president and VP of the Oasis User Council, but that was a no-brainer. Like most Gunters, I voted to re-elect Cory Doctorow and Will Wheaton, again. There were no term limits, and those two geezers had been doing a kick-ass job of protecting user rights for over a decade. When I finished voting, I adjusted my haptic chair slightly and studied the command console in front of me. It was crammed with switches, buttons, keyboards, joysticks, and display screens. A bank of security monitors on my left were linked to virtual cameras placed throughout the interior and exterior of my stronghold. To my right, another bank of monitors displayed all of my favorite news and entertainment vid feeds. Among these was my own channel, Parzival TV, broadcasting obscure, eclectic crap, 24/7, 365. Earlier that year, GSS had added a new feature to every Oasis user's account, the POV, Personal Oasis Vid Feed channel. It allowed anyone who paid a monthly fee to run their own streaming television network. Anyone logged into the simulation could tune in and watch your POV channel from anywhere in the world. What you aired on your channel and who you allowed to view it were entirely up to you. Most users chose to run a voyeur channel, which was like being the star of your own 24-hour reality show. Hovering virtual cameras would follow your avatar around the Oasis as you went about your day-to-day activities. You could limit access to your channel so that only your friends could watch, or you could charge viewers by the hour to access your POV. A lot of second-tier celebrities and pornographers did this, selling their virtual lives at a per-minute premium. Some people used their POV to broadcast live video of their real-world selves, or their dog, or their kids. Some people programmed nothing but old cartoons. The possibilities were endless, and the variety of stuff available seemed to grow more twisted every day. Non-stop foot fetish videos broadcast out of Eastern Europe. Amateur porn featuring deviant soccer moms in Minnesota. You name it, every flavor of weirdness the human psyche could cook up was being filmed and broadcast online. The vast wasteland of television programming had finally reached its zenith, and the average person was no longer limited to 15 minutes of fame. Now everyone could be on TV, every second of every day, whether or not anyone was watching. Parzival TV wasn't a voyeur channel. In fact, I never showed my avatar's face on my vid feed. Instead, I programmed a selection of classic 80s TV shows, retro commercials, cartoons, music videos, and movies. Lots of movies. On the weekends, I showed old Japanese monster flicks, along with some vintage anime. Whatever struck my fancy. It didn't really matter what I programmed. My avatar was still one of the high five, so my vid feed drew millions of viewers every day, regardless of what I aired, and this allowed me to sell commercial time to my various sponsors. Most of Parzival TV's regular viewers were Gunters who monitored my vid feed with the hope that I'd inadvertently reveal some key piece of information about the Jade Key or the egg itself. I never did, of course. At the moment, Parzival TV was wrapping up a non-stop two-day Kikader marathon. Kikader was a late 70s Japanese action show about a red and blue android who beat the crap out of rubber-suited monsters in each episode. I had a weakness for vintage kaiju and tokusatsu, shows like Spectre Man, The Space Giants, and Supaidaman. I pulled up my programming grid and made a few changes to my evening lineup. I cleared away the episodes of Riptide and Misfits of Science I'd programmed and dropped in a few back-to-back flicks starring Gamera, my favorite giant flying turtle. I thought they should be real crowd-pleasers. Then, to finish off the broadcast day, I added a few episodes of Silver Spoons. Artemis also ran her own vidfeed channel, Artemivision, and I always kept one of my monitors tuned to it. Right now, she was airing her usual Monday evening fare, an episode of Square Pegs. After that would be Electra Woman and Dyna Girl, followed by back-to-back episodes of Isis and Wonder Woman. Her programming lineup hadn't changed in ages, but it didn't matter. She still got killer ratings. Recently, she'd also launched her own wildly successful clothing line for full-figured female avatars under the label Artemis, M-I-S-S. She was doing really well for herself. After that night in the distracted globe, Artemis had cut off all contact with me. She blocked all of my emails, phone calls, and chat requests. She also stopped making posts to her blog. I tried everything I could think of to reach her. I sent her avatar flowers. I made multiple trips to her avatar's stronghold, an armored palace on Benatar, the small moon she owned. I dropped mixtapes and notes on her palace from the air, like lovesick bombs. Once, in a supreme act of desperation, I stood outside her palace gates for 2 solid hours with a boombox over my head, blasting In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel at full volume. She didn't come out. I don't even know if she was home. I'd been living in Columbus for over 5 months now, and it had been 8 long, torturous weeks since I'd last spoken to Artemis. But I hadn't spent that time moping around and feeling sorry for myself. Well, not all of it, anyway. I'd tried to enjoy my new life as a world-famous sector-hopping gunter. Even though I'd maxed out my avatar's power level, I continued to complete as many quests as possible to add to my already impressive collection of weapons, magic items, and vehicles, which I kept in a vault deep within my stronghold. Questing kept me busy and served as a welcome distraction from the growing loneliness and isolation I felt. I'd tried to reconnect with H after Artemis had dumped me, but things weren't the same. We'd grown apart, and I knew it was my fault. Our conversations were now stilted and reserved, as if we were both afraid of revealing some key piece of information the other might be able to use. I could tell he no longer trusted me, and while I'd been off obsessing over Artemis, it seemed H had become obsessed with being the first gunter to find the Jade Key. But it had been almost half a year since we'd cleared the first gate, and the Jade Key's location still remained a mystery. I hadn't spoken to H in almost a month. My last conversation with him had devolved into a shouting match, which had ended when I reminded H that he, quote, never even would have found the copper key, unquote, if I hadn't led him straight to it. He'd glared at me in silence for a second, then logged out of the chat room. Stubborn pride kept me from calling him back right away to apologize, and now it seemed like too much time had passed. Yeah, I was on a roll. In less than 6 months, I'd managed to wreck both of my closest friendships. I flipped over to H's channel, which he called the H feed. He was currently showing a WWF match from the late 80s featuring Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant. I didn't even bother checking Daito and Shoto's channel, the Dai Show, because I knew they'd be showing some old samurai movie. That's all those guys ever aired. A few months after our confrontational first meeting in H's basement, I'd managed to form a tenuous friendship with Daito and Shoto when the three of us teamed up to complete an extended quest in Sector 22. It was my idea. I felt bad about how our first encounter had ended, and I waited for an opportunity to extend some sort of olive branch to the two samurai. It came when I discovered a hidden high-level quest called Shodai Urutoraman on the planet Tokusatsu. The creation date in the quest's colophon said it had been launched several years after Halliday's death, which meant it couldn't have any relation to the contest. It was also a Japanese language quest created by GSS's Hokkaido division. I could have tried to complete it on my own using the Mandarax real-time translator software installed in all Oasis accounts, but it would have been risky. Mandarax had been known to garble or misinterpret quest instructions and clues, which could easily lead to fatal mistakes. Daito and Shoto lived in Japan. They'd become national heroes there. And I knew that they both spoke Japanese and English fluently. So I'd contacted them to ask if they were interested in teaming up with me just for this one quest. They were skeptical at first, but after I described the unique nature of the quest and what I believed the payoff for solving it might be, they finally agreed. The three of us met outside the quest gate on Tokusatsu and entered it together. The quest was a recreation of all 39 episodes of the original Ultraman TV series, which had aired on Japanese television from 1966 to 1967. The show's storyline centered around a human named Hayata, who was a member of the Science Patrol an organization devoted to fighting the hordes of giant Godzilla-like monsters that were constantly attacking Earth and threatening human civilization. When the Science Patrol encountered a threat they couldn't handle on their own, Hayata would use an alien device called a beta capsule to transform into an alien super being known as Ultraman. Then, he would proceed to kick the monster of the week's ass using all sorts of kung fu moves and energy attacks. If I'd entered the quest gate by myself, I would have automatically played through the entire series storyline as Hayata. But because Shoto, Daito, and I had all entered at once, we were each allowed to select a different Science Patrol team member to play. We could then change or swap characters at the start of the next level or episode. The three of us took turns playing Hayata and his Science Patrol teammates Hoshino and Arashi. As with most quests in the Oasis, playing as a team made it easier to defeat the various enemies and complete each of the levels. It took us an entire week, often playing over 16 hours a day, before we were finally able to clear all 39 levels and complete the quest. As we stepped out of the quest gate, our avatars were each awarded a huge amount of experience points and several thousand credits. But the real prize for completing the quest was an incredibly rare artifact, Hayata's Beta Capsule. The small metal cylinder allowed the avatar who possessed it to transform into Ultraman once a day for up to 3 minutes. Since there were three of us, there was a debate over who should be allowed to keep the artifact. Parzival should have it, Shoto had said, turning to his older brother. He found this quest. We wouldn't even have known about it were it not for him. Of course, Daito had disagreed, and he would not have been able to complete the quest without our help. He said the only fair thing to do would be to auction off the beta capsule and split the proceeds. But there was no way I could allow that. The artifact was far too valuable to sell, and I knew it would end up in the hands of the Sixers because they purchased nearly every major artifact that went up for auction. I also saw this as an opportunity to get on Daisho's good side. You should keep the beta capsule, I said. Urutoraman is Japan's greatest superhero. His powers belong in Japanese hands. They were both surprised and humbled by my generosity, especially Daito. Thank you, Parzival-san, he said, bowing low. You are a man of honor. After that, the three of us had parted as friends, if not necessarily allies, and I considered that an ample reward for my efforts. A chime sounded in my ears, and I checked the time. It was almost 8 o'clock. Time to make the donuts. I was always hard up for cash, no matter how frugal I tried to be. I had several large bills to pay each month, both in the real world and in the Oasis. My real world expenses were pretty standard: rent, electricity, food, water, hardware repairs and upgrades. My avatar's expenses were far more exotic: spacecraft repairs, teleportation fees, power cells, ammunition. I purchased my ammo in bulk, but it still wasn't cheap, and my monthly teleportation expenses were often astronomical. My search for the egg required constant travel, and GSS kept raising their teleportation fares. I'd already spent all of my remaining product endorsement dough. Most of it went toward the cost of my rig and buying my own asteroid. I earned a decent amount of money each month by selling commercial time on my POV channel and by auctioning off any unneeded magic items, armor, or weapons I acquired during my travels. But my primary source of income was my full-time job doing Oasis technical support. When I'd created my new Bryce Lynch identity, I'd given myself a college degree, along with multiple technical certifications and a long, sterling work record as an Oasis programmer and app developer. However, despite my sterling, bogus resume, the only job I'd ever been able to get was as a Tier 1 technical support representative at Helpful Help Desk Incorporated, one of the contract firms GSS used to handle Oasis customer service and support. Now, I worked 40 hours a week, helping morons reboot their Oasis consoles and update the drivers for their haptic gloves. It was grueling work, but it paid the rent. I logged out of my own Oasis account, then used my rig to log into a separate Oasis account I'd been issued for work. The login process completed, and I took control of a happy help desk avatar, a cookie-cutter Ken doll that I used to take tech support calls. This avatar appeared inside a huge virtual call center, inside a virtual cubicle, sitting at a virtual desk, in front of a virtual computer, wearing a virtual phone headset. I thought of this place as my own private virtual hell. Helpful Help Desk Incorporated took millions of calls a day from all over the world. 24/7, 365. One angry, befuddled cretin after another. There was no downtime between calls because there were always several hundred morons in the call queue, all of them willing to wait on hold for hours to have a tech rep hold their hand and fix their problem. Why bother looking up the solution online? Why try to figure the problem out on your own when you could have someone else do your thinking for you? As usual, my 10-hour shift passed slowly. It was impossible for help desk avatars to leave their cubicles, but I found other ways to pass the time. My work account was rigged so that I couldn't browse outside websites, but I'd hacked my visor to allow me to listen to music or stream movies off my hard drive while I took calls. When my shift finally ended and I logged out of work, I immediately logged back into my own Oasis account. I had thousands of new email messages waiting, and I could tell just by their subject lines what had happened while I'd been at work. Artemis had found the Jade Key. Chapter 21. Like other Gunters around the globe, I'd been dreading the next change on the scoreboard because I knew it was going to give the Sixers an unfair advantage. A few months after we'd all cleared the first gate, an anonymous avatar had placed an ultra-powerful artifact up for auction. It was called Findoro's Tablet of Finding, and it had unique powers that could give its owner a huge advantage in the hunt for Halliday's Easter egg. Most of the virtual items in the Oasis were created by the system at random, and they would drop when you killed an NPC or completed a quest. The rarest such items were artifacts, super powerful magic items that gave their owners incredible abilities. Only a few hundred of these artifacts existed, and most of them dated back to the earliest days of the Oasis, when it was still primarily an MMO game. Every artifact was unique, meaning that only one copy of it existed in the entire simulation. Usually, the way to obtain an artifact was to defeat some godlike villain at the end of a high-level quest. If you got lucky, the bad guy would drop an artifact when you killed him. You could also obtain an artifact by killing an avatar who had one in its inventory, or by purchasing one in an online auction. Since artifacts were so rare, it was always big news when one went up for auction. Some had been known to sell for hundreds of thousands of credits, depending on their powers. The record had been set 3 years ago, when an artifact called the Cataclyst was auctioned off. According to its auction listing, the Cataclyst was a sort of magical bomb, and it could be used only once. When it was detonated, it would kill every single avatar and NPC in the sector, including its owner. There was no defense against it. If you were unlucky enough to be in the same sector when it went off, you were a goner, regardless of how powerful or well protected you were. The Cataclyst had sold to an anonymous bidder for just over 1 million credits. The artifact still hadn't been detonated, so its new owner still had it sitting around somewhere, waiting for the right time to use it. It was something of a running joke now. When a Gunter was surrounded by avatars she didn't like, she would claim to have the Cataclyst in her inventory and threaten to detonate it. But most people suspected that the item had actually fallen into the Sixers' hands, along with countless other powerful artifacts. Findoro's Tablet of Finding wound up selling for even more than the Cataclyst. According to the auction description, the tablet was a flat circle of polished black stone, and it had one very simple power. Once a day, its owner could write any avatar's name on its surface, and the tablet would display that avatar's location at that exact moment. However, this power had range limitations. If you were in a different Oasis sector than the avatar you were trying to find, the tablet would tell you only which sector your target was currently in. If you were already in the same sector, the tablet would tell you what planet your target was currently on, or closest to if they were out in space. If you were already on the same planet as your target when you used the tablet, it would show you their exact coordinates on a map. As the artifact seller made sure to point out in his auction listing, if you used the tablet's power in conjunction with the scoreboard, it arguably became the most valuable artifact in the entire Oasis. All you had to do was watch the top rankings on the scoreboard and wait until someone's score increased. The second that happened, you could write that avatar's name on the tablet and it would tell you where they were at that exact moment, thus revealing the location of the key they'd just found or the gate they'd just exited. Due to the artifact's range limitations, it might take two or three attempts to narrow down the exact location of a key or gate, but even so, that was still information a lot of people would be willing to kill for. When Findoro's Tablet of Finding went up for auction, a huge bidding war broke out between several of the large Gunter clans. But when the auction finally ended, the tablet wound up selling to the Sixers for almost 2 million credits. Sorrento himself used his own IOI account to bid on the tablet. He waited until the last few seconds of the auction and then outbid everyone. He could have bid anonymously, but he obviously wanted the world to know who now possessed the artifact. It was also his way of letting those of us in the High Five know that from that moment forward, whenever one of us found a key or cleared a gate, the Sixers would be tracking us, and there was nothing we could do about it. At first, I was worried the Sixers would also try to use the tablet to hunt down each of our avatars and kill us one at a time. But locating our avatars wouldn't do them any good unless we happened to be in a PvP zone at the time and were stupid enough to stay put until the Sixers could reach us. And since the tablet could be used only once a day, they would also run the risk of missing their window of opportunity if the scoreboard changed on the same day they tried to use the tablet to locate one of us. They didn't take the chance. They kept the artifact in reserve and waited for their moment. Less than a half hour after Artemis's score increase, the entire Sixer fleet was spotted converging on Sector 7. The moment the scoreboard changed, the Sixers had obviously used Findoro's Tablet of Finding to try to ascertain Artemis's exact location. Luckily, the Sixer avatar using the tablet, probably Sorrento himself, happened to be in a different sector from Artemis, so the tablet didn't reveal what planet she was on. It only told the Sixers which sector she was currently in. And so the entire Sixer fleet had immediately hightailed it to Sector 7. Thanks to their complete lack of subtlety, the whole world now knew the Jade Key must be hidden somewhere in that sector. Naturally, thousands of Gunters began to converge on it too. The Sixers had narrowed the search area for everyone. Luckily, Sector 7 contained hundreds of planets, moons, and other worlds, and the Jade Key could have been hidden on any one of them. I spent the rest of the day in shock, reeling at the news that I'd been dethroned. That was exactly how the newsfeed headlines put it. Parzival dethroned! Artemis, new number one Gunter! Sixers closing in! Once I finally got a grip, I pulled up the scoreboard and made myself stare at it for 30 solid minutes while I mentally berated myself. High scores. Number 1, Artemis, 129,000. Number 2, Parzival, 110,000. Number 3, H, 108,000. Number 4, Daito, 107,000. Number 5, Shoto, 106,000. Number 6, IOI, 655321, 105,000. Number 7, IOI, 643187, 105,000. Number 8, IOI, 621671, 105,000. Number 9, IOI, 678324, 105,000. Number 10, IOI, 637330, 105,000. "You've got no one but yourself to blame," I told myself. "You let success go to your head. You slacked off on your research. What, did you think lightning would strike twice? That eventually you'd just stumble across the clue you needed to find the jade key? Sitting in first place all that time gave you a false sense of security. But you don't have that problem now, do you, asshead? No, because instead of buckling down and focusing on your quest like you should have, you pissed away your lead. You wasted almost half a year screwing around and pining over some girl you've never even met in person. The girl who dumped you. The same girl who was going to end up beating you. Now, get your head back in the game, moron. Find that key." Suddenly, I wanted to win the contest more than ever. Not just for the money. I wanted to prove myself to Artemis. And I wanted the hunt to be over so that she would talk to me again. So that I could finally meet her in person, see her true face, and try to make sense of how I felt about her. I cleared the scoreboard off my display and opened up my Grail diary, which had now grown into a vast mountain of data containing every scrap of information I'd collected since the contest began. It appeared as a jumble of cascading windows floating in front of me, displaying text, maps, photos, and audio and video files, all indexed, cross-referenced, and pulsing with life. I kept the quatrain open in a window that was always on top. 4 lines of text, 24 words, 34 syllables. I'd stared at them so often and for so long that they'd nearly lost all meaning. Looking at them again now, I had to resist the urge to scream in rage and frustration. "The captain conceals the jade key in a dwelling long neglected, but you can only blow the whistle once the trophies are all collected." I knew the answer was right there in front of me. Artemis had already figured it out. I read over my notes about John Draper, a.k.a. Captain Crunch, and the toy plastic whistle that had made him famous in the annals of hacker lore. I still believed that these were the captain and whistle Halliday was referring to, but the rest of the quatrain's meaning remained a mystery. But now I possessed a new piece of information. The key was somewhere in Sector 7. So I pulled up my Oasis Atlas and began to search for planets with names I thought might somehow be related to the quatrain. I found a few worlds named after famous hackers, like Woz and Mitnick, but none named after John Draper. Sector 7 also contained hundreds of worlds named after old Usenet news groups, and on one of these, the planet Alt Freaking, there was a statue of Draper posing with an ancient rotary phone in one hand and a cap and crunch whistle in the other. But the statue had been erected 3 years after Halliday's death, so I knew it was a dead end. I read through the quatrain yet again, and this time, the last 2 lines jumped out at me. "But you can only blow the whistle once the trophies are all collected." Trophies. Somewhere in Sector 7. I needed to find a collection of trophies in Sector 7. I did a quick search of my files on Halliday. From what I could tell, the only trophies he'd ever owned were the 5 Game Designer of the Year awards he'd won back around the turn of the century. These trophies were still on display in the GSS Museum in Columbus, but there were replicas of them on display inside the Oasis on a planet called Arcade. And Arcade was located in Sector 7. The connection seemed thin, but I still wanted to check it out. At the very least, it would make me feel like I was doing something productive for the next few hours. I glanced over at Max, who is currently doing the Samba on one of my command center's monitors. Max, prep the Vonnegut for takeoff, if you're not too busy. Max stopped dancing and smirked at me. You got it, El Comanchero! I got up and walked over to my Stronghold's elevator, which I'd modeled after the turbo lift on the original Star Trek series. I rode down 4 levels to my armory, a massive vault filled with storage shelves, display cases, and weapon racks. I pulled up my avatar's inventory display, which appeared as a classic paper doll diagram of my avatar, onto which I could drag and drop various items and pieces of equipment. Arcade was located in a PvP zone, so I decided to upgrade my gear and wear my Sunday best. I put on my gleaming +10 hail mail powered armor, then strapped on my favorite set of blaster pistols and slung a pump action pistol grip shotgun across my back, along with a +5 Vorpal Bastard sword. I also grabbed a few other essential items, an extra pair of anti-grav boots, a ring of magic resistance, an amulet of protection, some gauntlets of giant strength. I hated the idea of needing something and not having it with me, so I usually ended up carrying enough equipment for 3 Gunters. When I ran out of room on my avatar's body, I stored the additional gear in my backpack of holding. Once I was properly outfitted, I hopped back on the elevator, and a few seconds later, I arrived at the entrance of my hangar, located on the bottom level of my stronghold. Pulsing blue lights lined the runway, which ran up the center of the hangar to a massive pair of armored doors at the far end. These doors opened into the launch tunnel, which led up to a matching set of armored doors set into the asteroid's surface. Standing on the left side of the runway was my battle-worn X-Wing fighter. Parked on the right side was my DeLorean. Sitting on the runway itself was my most frequently used spacecraft, the Vonnegut. Max had already powered up the engines, and they emitted a low, steady roar that filled the hangar. The Vonnegut was a heavily modified Firefly-class transport vessel, modeled after the Serenity in the classic Firefly TV series. The ship had been named the Kaylee when I'd first obtained it, but I'd immediately rechristened it after one of my favorite 20th century novelists. Its new name was stenciled on the side of its battered gray hull. I'd looted the Vonnegut from a cadre of Oviraptor clansmen who had foolishly attempted to hijack my X-Wing while I was cruising through a large group of worlds in Sector 11, known as the Whedonverse. The Oviraptors were cocky bastards with no clue who it was they were messing with. I was in a foul mood even before they'd opened fire on me. Otherwise, I probably would have just evaded them by jumping to light speed. But that day, I decided to take their attack personally. Ships were like most other items in the Oasis. Each one had specific attributes, weapons, and speed capabilities. My X-Wing was far more maneuverable than the Oviraptor's large transport ship, so it was no trouble for me to avoid the barrage from their aftermarket guns while I bombarded them with laser bolts and proton torpedoes. After I disabled their engines, I boarded the ship and proceeded to kill every avatar there. The captain tried to apologize when he saw who I was, but I wasn't in a forgiving mood. After I'd dispatched the crew, I parked my X-Wing in the cargo hold and then cruised home in my new ship. As I approached the Vonnegut, the loading ramp extended to the hangar floor. By the time I reached the cockpit, the ship was already lifting off. I heard the landing gear retract with a thud just as I seated myself at the controls. Max, lock up the house and set a course for Arcade. Aye, Captain! Max stuttered from one of the cockpit monitors. The hangar doors slid open, and the Vonnegut rocketed out the launch tunnel and up into the starry sky. As the ship cleared the surface, the armored tunnel doors slammed closed behind it. I spotted several ships camped out in a high orbit above Falco. The usual suspects. Crazed fans, wannabe disciples, and aspiring bounty hunters. A few of them, the ones